Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Today, we're going to talk about the tensions between the federal government and states. President Trump insisted this week that he holds ultimate authority to dictate when the country can reopen. Meanwhile, governors in several states in the Northeast and the Northwest and the West in general announced the formation of coalitions to coordinate reopening regionally. So what is the ideal way for officials to work together for the good of all citizens? This hour on Point, governors, the president, and the pandemic. Now, in a moment, we'll talk with Kathleen Sebelius about this, the former Health and Human Services Secretary and Kansas governor. We'll start, though, with Anthony Brooks, On Point's 2020 correspondent and WBUR senior political reporter. He's in Dublin, New Hampshire. Hi there, Anthony.
Hi, Meghna.
Well, you know, I mentioned the fact that the president this week said he had ultimate authority. I just want to start our conversation by playing more of what the president said. This is during the daily briefing on Monday.
The president of the United States has the authority to do what the president has the authority to do, which is very powerful. The president of the United States calls the shots. If we weren't here for the states, you would have had a problem in this country like you've never seen before. We were here to back them up, and we've more than backed them up. We did a job that nobody ever thought was possible. It's a decision for the president of the United States.
So, Anthony, first of all, how did governors respond to the president saying that?
Yeah, and that followed a statement that he had said earlier where he did use that term total authority, and that was in the context of suggesting that he could tell the governors what to do with regard to their plans to reopen their states for business. And that's been pretty flatly rejected by Democratic governors as well as other Republicans across the country. Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic governor of New York, said even in an emergency, the president doesn't get to be king. People like Liz Cheney, the representative from Wyoming, she's one of the senior one of the most senior women in Congress. She said the federal government does not have absolute power and went on to quote the text from the 10th Amendment, which you know basically says what powers aren't given specifically to the president are reserved to the states. And so this was pretty much flatly rejected, this idea. And then President Trump seemed to walk it back a little bit. And he said that he's going to be talking to all 50 governors, and I will then be authorizing each individual governor of each individual state to implement a reopening. Now, that's a strange comment because in a way, the governors don't need Trump to authorize these moves. They have the authority. They're the ones that impose the lockdown orders, the school closure orders and that sort of stuff. And they're the ones who have ultimate authority to reopen them. So it just created this kind of constitutional kerfuffle and a lot of noise about presidential authority. And, you know, I think for the most part, the governors are getting on with the work that they're doing, trying to save lives.
Okay, well, let's listen to the president himself saying what you just mentioned, Anthony, about his walking back a little bit on Tuesday of his claim to total authority.
I will be speaking to all 50 governors very shortly, and I will then be authorizing each individual governor of each individual state to implement a reopening and a very powerful reopening plan of their state at a time and in a manner as most appropriate.
So that's the president on Tuesday. On the same day, California Governor Gavin Newsom, in his daily press conference, shared his reopening plan for California. He described it as a fourth phase and had this to say about the factors that will determine when that can happen.
This phase is one where science, where public health, not politics, must be the guide, where we must be open to argument, interested in evidence, where we cannot be ideological in any way, shape, or form in terms of how we approach a condition that changes on an hourly and daily basis, conditions that will ultimately determine what better decisions we make in terms of that transition.
That's California Governor Gavin Newsom also on Tuesday. So, Anthony, a couple of things there. First of all, just so that we're clear, is there any legal justification for the president's claim? You mentioned Senator Cheney saying, you know, the 10th Amendment, but is there any claim?
Yeah, Congresswoman Cheney, it doesn't seem to be. You know, I'm not the legal expert, but I will say that I've done as much reading on this as I can, and I haven't found a legal expert who sort of said, yeah, the president has the authority to do that. Look, this country was set up as a federalist system. There's a lot of power that the states have. The president has a lot of authority, but one thing he doesn't have is an authority to sort of overrule governors as they try to implement things like stay-at-home orders and other issues that protect their citizens directly. The power isn't there. Now, that said, the president does have an extraordinary amount of power. He can claim extra power during emergencies, and we can talk about that as the hour goes on. But I think if you think about sort of the implications of what he's saying, I mean, imagine a presidential order basically saying to a city mayor, you know, you've got to reopen your schools. I mean, that's just not where federal authority lies. And most of the legal experts, all the legal experts that I've read on this pretty much concur with that. Mm-hmm. And you heard the president sort of backpedaling there. But even in his as he backpedaled, he said he will be authorizing each individual governor to implement a reopening. He doesn't have authority to do that any more than he could have prevented governors from shutting down their states and trying to save lives. The divisions of power in our system just do not allow that to happen.
Mm. So in a moment, Anthony, let's talk a little bit more about these regional compacts, essentially, that governors are making. But I am curious what your thought is on why there is a sort of a resistance for beyond the legal issues for governors to be more conciliatory towards the president.
Well, I mean, it depends who you're talking
about. Yeah.
Here's an interesting case in point. And Meghna, I know you're familiar with this because you're in Boston, and I've been covering Governor Charlie Baker a lot. He's a Republican governor in basically a blue state. But, you know, he has been trying to sort of block out the sort of noise around this and just stay focused on trying to save lives and doing what he needs to do. But the reason why, you know, he wants the independence to do what he thinks is right is he's making these decisions based on science, based on what he's hearing from medical experts. And when he talks about reopening, he says before we can even have a serious conversation about reopening Massachusetts, for example, we've got to be sure that we've ramped up testing so that we can do a serious effort at contact tracing. We've got to make sure the infection rates are manageable. That is, that they're not still growing at an exponential level. And we have to really think about which businesses, which institutions, which organizations, schools, and so forth are in a place where they can reopen. And the other thing they're talking about, and you mentioned this, is they want to cooperate with neighboring states because it's not going to make sense, for example, for, let's say, New Hampshire, from where I'm talking to you right now, to say, yeah, we're open for business. And Massachusetts remains closed. And obviously that would allow people to cross the line, which we do every single day, going back and forth to work and moving into one area that is opened and back into another area where that's closed and carrying infection or the risk of infection back and forth across state lines. So, of course, the governors want to cooperate very carefully with each other. So that's another reason why they have to have a certain amount of independence from Washington and from the president's idea of when he would like the country to reopen.
Mm. And same logic goes, as you noted, for those Western states that are also
Absolutely.
Working together here. But the Trump administration is going to be releasing their guidelines for when the country reopens. Is there a sense that just wondering, Anthony, if you think there's going to be a lot of overlap there? Could this be a door to more federal-state cooperation?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think the president walking back that statement that he made Monday was sort of a signal that there's going to be more cooperation. And I want to be clear. I think there is a lot of cooperation. I mean, to go back to the example of Charlie Baker, Republican, who's no big fan of Donald Trump, you know, he makes the point that the states have to make these decisions on their own. But he also makes the point that he talks to FEMA every day, for example. They're dependent on cooperating with the federal government on a number of levels, whether it's trying to get hold of more ventilators, more personal protection equipment from the national stockpile, even trying to figure out how to pay extra unemployment benefits. They need guidance from the federal government after the CARES bill was passed by Congress, for example. So there's a lot of cooperation that goes on a daily basis, notwithstanding these sort of extraordinary statements that we hear sometimes coming from the White House.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because we see governors, I'm thinking particularly Republican governors like Charlie Baker, who are trying to sort of walk this thin line of not getting on the president's bad side while at the same time struggling against as a state against the federal government. What about, for example, other Republican governors, Mike DeWine in Ohio?
Yeah, Mike DeWine's an interesting case in point because, like you said, I mean, I think you expressed it well. He's walking a fine line, and I'm looking at a quote from him recently. This is not a confrontational issue between us and the White House. We work together, and we will continue to work together, he said. You know, at the same time, he's determined to lay out a plan that makes sense for Ohio. And he's made statements that he wants to be informed by science and what makes sense for that state. So, but like Baker, as a Republican, you know, he's not sort of going out on a, not out on a limb, but he's trying to sort of tune out and look beyond the kind of noise that has been built up this week because of this statement by President Trump. But there's no question as well that the president does have a certain kind of influence, particularly with Republican governors in states where the president still remains very popular. And that's part of the power that he has to sort of use the bully pulpit to kind of encourage people to say, come on, we've got to open up. We got to get back to business. We got to get this economy up and running. And that's a big part of the power, legitimate or not, that he does have.
Well, we are talking this hour about the tensions between governors, at least some governors, and the president as the nation tries to battle the COVID-19 pandemic. Anthony Brooks is with us. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent. And when we come back, we'll be hearing from former U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about tensions between governors and the Trump administration and what's the best way for state and federal officials to work together to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent. He's with us from Dublin, New Hampshire. And joining us now is Kathleen Sebelius. From 2009 to 2014, she served as the U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary in the Obama administration. Prior to that, she was the two-term governor of Kansas. She's also been elected twice as the state's insurance commissioner and is currently CEO of Sebelius Resources, LLC. And she joins us from Lawrence, Kansas. Secretary Sebelius, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Magna. It's good to be with you.
I wonder if first we can lean on your experience as a governor. If you were occupying a statehouse right now, what strategy would you use to deal with the federal government at the moment?
Well, it is a little baffling, I think, and trickier than any relationship I had. I was a Democratic governor the entire time I was governor. George W. Bush was president, so I had a partisan difference, if you will, with the president. I wasn't part of his party or his team. Having said that, I think the relationships were pretty straightforward in terms of, you know, what the federal government would be asked to do, what the states could and would do. And there was always a sense, at least that I had during my tenure, that we were all treated the same, that the rules were pretty clear. We would, in a very bipartisan way, ask for things. I mean, for instance, there was always a debate about money. States always wanted more money and less rules. The feds wanted not necessarily to give us more money, but certainly to have control over what that money did. So that was a pretty typical debate. And Republicans and Democrats, as governors, joined it together. I think what's very difficult about this particular period is the Trump administration seems to have a bit upended what that relationship is. So in a disaster, and I had a number when I was governor, mm-hmm. nothing, I should say, comparing to this, I won't even begin to do it, but natural disasters that took out towns or floods or, you know, very difficult situations where we lost lives and lost jobs and we definitely needed help. But the way the kind of food chain works is you start with local resources, and local government is the first line of defense, the first responders, the first people on the scene. They then call on the state for additional help and resources, and the state, the governor can mobilize the National Guard, send agency help, send additional money, and if the disaster then rises to a certain level, the state turns to the federal government and makes that same kind of request, a disaster declaration, additional resources, finances, personnel, materials. And what has happened here is, I think, again, when states uniformly called on the federal government for supplies, for equipment, they were all looking for the same kinds of things. They needed ventilators. They needed personal protective equipment for their first responders. They needed additional resources. Some of that got a bit of a pushback, and they were told, no, that's really up to the states to figure out on their own. They should just go find it.
Yeah, can I just ask you briefly there, because I think I'm curious about how a governor manages the inconsistency of messaging from Washington, because this, by definition, as you've pointed out, it very quickly became a disaster that was magnified beyond the scope of individual governors to manage. But as you said, then when they turned to the federal government and said, you know, we need ventilators, we need masks, and one of the first messages they heard was, well, no, you don't, or the president saying, Andrew Cuomo saying he needs 30,000 ventilators, I don't think he needs that many. But then later on, the president, as Anthony was pointing us to this week, he's like, well, I actually have total authority. I mean, there's a sense of leadership whiplash, which if you're a governor and you – in order to save lives of the people in your state, you know you're going to need some consistency from the federal level. How do you manage that?
Well, I think that's one of the things that's got to be incredibly difficult that I frankly didn't see. I wanted to make it clear that even with a partisan, difference with the president when I was serving, there was not a sense that there were red states and blue states. There wasn't a sense that if you asked for what you needed, you were called out and criticized for being unappreciative or mean or whatever. I've never seen a situation where a president singles out governors and calls them names and belittles their requests, mocks what they're asking for. And I think that has to, it's not just what's going on in front of the cameras, but I think it puts governors in a very difficult position. Do you then have to not ask for what you need? Do you do it to some other entity? What are you supposed to do? You get criticized for not asking for supplies and materials on one hand, and if you ask for them, then you're called unappreciative or, you know, mean-spirited or making things up. It is a very difficult, I think, whipsaw. What I've been told, and our current governor, who was just elected in 2018, who I've known for a long time, in fact, was my next-door neighbor for 20 years, she has said, and her staff has told me, that the meetings that went on that Mike Pence was running for a while were pretty orderly and straightforward. And in some ways that makes sense because Mike Pence was a governor and understands this role and had very straightforward discussions with people. They said once those meetings, then the president joined those meetings, they got pretty chaotic also and less useful. But the traditional lines of authority and command do seem to be very confusing in this current day and age.
And you're referring there to Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, right?
I am.
So, you know, in a couple of minutes, Secretary, I'm going to ask you about, we're going to look back a little bit because I'd love to get your view on what the past 4 months have been like at the federal level. But I do just want to hear from you first, though. What, as Anthony pointed out a couple of minutes ago, the president does actually have considerable, lots of power here to do things that would be transformative in fighting this pandemic. I mean, given where we are right now in the middle of April, what would you like to see him do that could really give us a handle, get us a handle on the pandemic?
Well, I think, Magna, since early February, we have been talking about testing. And we're still talking about testing in the middle of April. We do not have enough tests. We do not have enough supplies for tests. We are not doing enough testing. That is a precursor to this opening up of the government. And I think the federal government is uniquely positioned to get the supplies, get the fast throughput tests organized, make contracts with labs all over the country, and push this forward. That needs to be done not on a state-by-state basis or on a happenstance basis. When every single state is looking for exactly the same materials, all that does is drive up the cost and put states in competition with one another. The federal government needs to be a purchasing and distribution agent immediately. So testing is number one, getting the resources. And I mean, not just working fast with Congress. I've been pleased to see Congress come together and push some resources out. But in addition to that, they can mobilize on a national basis some federal personnel. So there is the Medical Commission Corps, people in the federal government who have various kinds of medical degrees and practice licenses, doctors, nurses, dentists, mental health professionals, others who are actually paid additional money and are available to be deployed. Often in a disaster, a group of them could be sent to a jurisdiction to help stand up a hospital or do whatever. I haven't heard any discussion of those folks being sent to various places to be on the ground and help replace and give some respite. When you think about first responders who have now been, you know, a month into dealing in this 24/7 crisis of very ill patients, they need some help and support, not just to make sure they don't get sick, but to also get a little rest along the way. So that kind of thing the federal government can do. And the federal government has resources, money. Mm. Most states have a constitutional framework that you cannot spend money you don't have. You have to have a balanced budget. a lot of state legislators, including Kansas, are actually home for the season. They meet for a couple of months at the beginning of the year, and then they're gone. So the federal government really is unique with a whole host of agencies, but also resources, personnel, and purchasing power and logistics that no state can replicate.
Right. So I'm going to take a deep breath here because I'm trying to figure out the right way to say this. So there has been, since the founding of this country, tensions between the state and federal governments. Understood. In fact, it's kind of baked into the system of government that we have here in the United States. And at times it's led to good things. At times it's led to bad things. It's a fact of sort of political life. But in the midst of a health crisis and now an economic crisis, I have to say it is ridiculous that there isn't greater cooperation between the federal government and states. To hear governors say, we're being outbid by the federal government on critical pieces of equipment. Or here's what I know because I'm hearing from my local public health officials about what we need and having the federal government say, well, we don't really believe you. I mean, this is costing lives.
Well, there's no question it's costing lives. And it is dangerous on the granular level not to have the federal government use its unique powers and resources to deliver goods and services that they can uniquely do and that they can get the best price for and do it in a fair and transparent manner. That's very important. It's very dangerous to have mixed messages coming out of the federal government, questioning everything from, you know, when we're going to open up and who's in charge of that to whether we have a serious disease, what's going on, because what that does is undermine any confidence that people are getting straight information in a very difficult time. I mean, people are losing lives, losing loved ones, and they're losing their income and their jobs. It's a terrifying period. And to have no leadership at the federal level delivering not only a message that has some hope and optimism, we're all in this together, we can get through this, but some kind of straightforward communication about what will be done, what the plan is, what people, that's very, very dangerous at this time. And Magna, I think one of the things that is troubling to me is, well, there are lots of things that are troubling to me, but one of them is we have to have a plan that takes us from mid-April to vaccinating the country. Mm-hmm. At a minimum, we're talking about a year to a year and a half. And so all we hear about, and that's even very mixed, is when we're going to open up. I feel like sometimes I'm in a car with my two-year-old who hasn't been two in a long time, who as we come out of the driveway and drive down the street, says, Mommy, are we there yet? Are we there yet now? Are we there now? How about now? How about now? And, you know, every parent has had that conversation. And it requires saying, no, actually, this is a long trip. We're going to grandma's house. It takes 5 hours. That's a long time. We'll stop halfway. And you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. We have nobody at the leadership level at the White House that could then be echoed by every governor in the country, but starting at the White House saying, we're going to get through this, but it's going to be a marathon and it's going to have steps and phases along the way. And here's how we're planning for that. And here's what's going to happen. If we think the fight over protective equipment is insane, states bidding against each other, and then materials being actually confiscated at the customs border and being turned into the federal stockpile that states or local governments have already paid for, that is also happening. Wait till we get to a vaccine, because the vaccine is not going to be available simultaneously for 330 million people. It will come gradually. It will be hopefully ramped up fairly quickly. But if people don't believe it's being distributed in a fair and equitable manner, if people don't understand how important it is first to get a flu vaccine as quickly as it comes out in the early fall, and then the second vaccine for COVID-19, we're going to have a wild stream of illnesses and unhappiness all over again.
Is President Trump the toddler in your analogy?
Well, you can draw whatever conclusion you want, but I think he definitely is somebody who, went on a stage and talked about packed churches at Easter and continues to have his major message about opening up the government. I don't even know what that means exactly. I don't know what the plan is. I don't know what the precursor is. When asked about what the metrics are, he points to his head and says, these are the metrics. That doesn't give me a lot of confidence that we will have some sort of system in place in a very, in a society that moves. I heard your conversation earlier about a cross border between, New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Well, Kansas City is on both sides of the state line.
Right.
People live on one side and work on the other side. People, if you want somebody to get on an airplane, they need more than just the fact that that state is in some kind of situation that they can know and trust. But what happens when you get off the plane on the other end? What's going on there? What has that, are we going to have a set of minimum requirements that every state has to follow to make it clear that this works, or is it going to be every person for himself? I mean, I don't know. No one is really talking about that.
Well, Anthony Brooks, you've been patiently listening here. We've got about 45 seconds before we have to hit that second break. But what's your reflections on what the secretary is saying?
No, it's fascinating, and it strikes a chord. I mean, for an example, states competing with the federal government. There was an example of that in Massachusetts, where the state government had ordered 3 million N95 masks, and as they were making their way to Massachusetts through the port of New York, the federal government impounded them, and they went into the national stockpile, which created all kinds of problems. So the governor of Massachusetts went around that and figured out a private relief mission to China to get his own N35 masks. And that's an example where cooperation with the federal government might have eased some of those complications and tensions, I guess.
And that private relief mission was on the airplane owned by the New England Patriots.
That's a key detail in that story.
at least for our New England listeners. So Anthony Brooks, stand by, and Secretary Sebelius, hang in there. We've got a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about tensions between some governors in the United States and the federal government, namely the president of the United States, and looking for answers about what the best way is for state, local, and federal officials to work together for the good of everyone in the middle of a historic pandemic. I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent. He's with us from Dublin, New Hampshire. And Kathleen Sebelius joins us as well. From 2009 to 2014, she served as the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services. Prior to that, she was a two-term governor of Kansas, and she's with us from Lawrence, Kansas. Secretary Sebelius, so we heard a lot from relying on your experience as governor. I want to talk now about what you learned in 2009 as HHS Secretary, and here's why, because the dates are actually quite remarkable. I was looking back and recalled that the CDC's first public alert about the H1N1 pandemic came out about April 24th, 2009. This was about 9 days after the initial detection of H1N1 in California. And if I have this right, you were sworn in as HHS secretary on April 28th, 2009, just 4 days later. So when you first stepped into the office as secretary, was there like an H1N1 briefing book on your desk that first day?
Well, actually, Meghna, it is even more bizarre than that. I got on a plane the day that the Senate began the debate on my confirmation, because the president sent a plane to get me. And even though I sort of protested, saying, well, I don't really have a job yet, they insisted that I get on the plane. And about halfway across the country was told that indeed I had been confirmed. I had left a note on my desk in Kansas, in the governor's office, saying, in the event I am confirmed, I hereby resign as governor, because I didn't want to resign in case I wasn't going to get confirmed. I arrived in D.C. In the evening, was taken right to the White House and sworn in the Oval Office, and then escorted by somebody to the Situation Room, which is in the West Wing in the lower level, because at that point, the team of the Homeland Security Secretary, who was my good friend Janet Napolitano, who had been the governor of Arizona, she was there. She was leading the team. There were some health officials there kind of waiting for me. And we were on the phone with the Mexican health minister and the Canadian health minister, because the disease actually had begun in Mexico and was coming up through the Americas. And so I spent 2.5 hours in the Situation Room the night I was confirmed, and the following day was on the phone with Margaret Chan from the World Health Organization, because this was clearly going to be a pandemic in waiting.
What was that 2.5 hours in the Situation Room that first night? What was discussed?
Well, I wish I could tell you line by line, but it was more sharing information. I mean, what was terrific about that entire experience was that Mexico, unlike China's role initially with this outbreak, Mexico was very transparent and not only shared information. So CDC very quickly identified an assay and had a test available, I think, the week I came into office, that mm-hmm. we were able to push out across the country and then eventually across the globe. So it was really sharing information about what the disease outbreak looked like. The terrifying thing about the H1N1 was, first, it hadn't been seen since 1918, and that didn't go so well in 1918, but also the initial presentation looked like we were going to have a different population than the typical flu that was susceptible. So young people with no pre-existing condition had died. Children had died. And that was really terrifying because it not only looked like it could be very lethal on top of a flu season, but it also had a whole different population at risk. And that became one of the real challenges.
Because it's interesting to me that in the early days of the 2009 H1N1 pandemic that you're talking about, that first couple of weeks, the federal response was, at least on the surface, quite similar to what we saw in the early days with the COVID-19 pandemic at the beginning of this year, because H1N1 was declared a public health emergency 11 days after that first confirmed case in 2009. Similarly, this time, HHS declared the COVID-19 a public health emergency also 11 days after the first U.S. identified case. But it seems as if the similarities stop there for a number of reasons. Now, one of them is, can you describe to me how willing of an ear did you have in President Obama when you had to brief him and talk with about him and advise him through the steps that the nation would need to take in order to combat H1N1?
Well, I think a couple of key differences. One is we had a test right away.
Right.
So we really could track the disease, and epidemiology becomes a really critical part of any unknown, novel virus or pathogen that's traveling. So being able to follow who was being infected, know a lot about the disease very quickly, who was getting sick, who had milder symptoms, that kind of thing. That was very, very different than what we're dealing with today, which is still kind of operating in the dark. But we also had a president, and now mind you, I was brand new. I was the last cabinet member, but he was pretty new. He had been sworn in January, around the 20th, 21st. So he hadn't been in office very long by the end of April. And, you know, there were certainly people around him who said, oh, my God, this could be the end of your presidency. I mean, there'll be dead bodies up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, and you have to do very dramatic and very quick things. And he said at every point along the way, which was incredibly courageous, we're going to listen to the science. We're going to go where the science tells us to do. There were people who insisted at several points along the way that we at HHS rewrite CDC guidance and say something different. And President Obama at each point would say, nope, we are going to follow the science. They'll tell us what they know. They'll tell us what they don't know. And that's what we're going to do. And he really believed in that. So that framework was incredibly helpful to, if you will, resist a lot of the political pressure and pulls back and forth, because he made it clear that CDC was the epidemiology expert and they needed to follow the disease and tell us what, you know, if schools would close, they would give the outline of what that should happen. What about workplaces? What about... He also immediately assembled an all-of-government approach. Every cabinet secretary was involved and briefed and ready to roll and met then with their constituencies about everything from how to get people paid leave, who should be tested, how we should do that. The other advantage I would say we had, Magna, is that because this was a flu virus,
right,
we could get a vaccine more quickly. There wasn't a particular vaccine for H1N1 at the time, but for decades, people had been making flu vaccines and putting different strains into a vaccine. So we had a really clear assay. We were very lucky that the first strike on would we get an effective target worked. And so we had a vaccine, I think, within 5 months.
Right. And that's actually an extremely important point to note about the differences between these two pandemics, because of course the novel coronavirus is novel. We've never seen it before, so vaccine development
right.
is starting from zero.
And there is no coronavirus vaccine. So,
exactly.
We know that.
Yeah. Just earlier this week, we talked to some researchers who are working on developing a vaccine, and they walked us through all the details of the challenges of starting from zero, essentially, and trying to accomplish what hasn't been done before by humanity in a year and a half. So that's I should be clear. It has never been done before by humanity in this fast a time scale. But,
correct.
But going back to, I'm still trying to understand sort of the importance of leadership and interagency cooperation and the deliberateness of how the federal government acts. I mean, you're talking about a president in President Obama who listened to you, who said he'd rely on the science, et cetera. Whereas, you know, just in the past couple of days, there's been some major reports coming out that current Secretary Alex Azar tried multiple times in January to convince President Trump of the seriousness of this pandemic and wasn't successful. I mean, what's your response to that? How does that land?
Well, I find that, again, troubling and terrifying. Because if indeed you have someone in that position with a lot of authority and a unique ability to communicate who is guided by anything other than the science in this particular environment, I think you're in a really tough position. And that's what really worries me tremendously, having watched this play out at the front end with a lot of denials and it's going to go away and don't take it seriously. It's just like the flu. I mean, I was stunned when the president acknowledged that it came as a total surprise to him that thousands of people died from the flu every year. You know, that's a pretty well-known public health fact, but he did not seem to understand or know that. But if he's listening to other voices and even making them weigh equally with the scientists, I think that's a very dangerous place to be. So, for instance, we had situations where, we knew we were going to have a vaccine fairly quickly. We knew that part of our challenge was to get the country ready to get vaccinated. And we, as you know, have an active debate with a portion of the population who is happy to assert that vaccinations are more dangerous than not getting vaccinated. And there was a point at which, you know, press was happy to give the anti-vaxxers equal time with the public health officials who were preparing people to be ready to get vaccinated, to get their kids vaccinated. Pregnant women needed to be vaccinated because they were going to be particularly hard hit by this. The president was very keen on using his bully pulpit at the time to really make it clear that having a debate about vaccination was dangerous and preposterous and that there was no evidence. So he used his microphone at very strategic times, not to, you know, give daily briefings. He wanted those briefings to come from the scientists and come from the, you know, Homeland Security folks who were mobilizing the rest of government, but also to make sure that he was the communicator that gave people a clear plan, gave them some hope, told them it would be all right, but also said to them, you know, when we get the medicine ready, you got to step up and take advantage of it, mm-hmm. things like that. So he used his authority to both equally distribute. We had a very transparent plan. We knew we wouldn't get enough vaccine right away for everybody. Everybody wanted it right away. They wanted to be at the front of the line. He was very transparent about how that would happen. It went according to CDC guidelines. You know, kids and hospital workers were first. Pregnant women were in line. I mean, we knew what the dangers were for various populations. He allocated it across the board. He used the government's logistics system to set up a whole vaccination system. So the kinds of things that the federal government did were hugely important, could not have been done by states, but everybody knew what the rules were and you know, that they were being treated fair and equitably.
Well, and the kinds of things that the federal government did, it's still capable of doing now, or should be capable of doing now. So, I mean, Secretary Sebelius, I've just got you for less than a minute here. Again, we're trying to seek solutions here on this show. So at the risk of repeating myself, I mean, if there's one piece of advice that you could give, I don't know, Secretary Azar right now, or the president himself, what would it be?
Well, it would be to use the unique authorities of the federal government. Get testing ramped up, push it out, you know, make it clear that that has to be a precursor. Listen to the scientists, and then really put in place what has to be a massive effort to not only manufacture, but begin to get people ready for both treatments and vaccines, but unify this country and stop having folks compete with one another. That uniquely can be done by the federal government. It has to be done if we're going to reopen the economy in a safe and secure manner and save lives. I think the notion that we've got to save lives and save jobs at the same time is really important, and it can't be one or the other.
Well, Kathleen Sebelius is former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services and also a former two-time governor of Kansas. Secretary Sebelius, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Magnet.
Well, Anthony, we've just got a couple of minutes left here. That was absolutely fascinating hearing the secretary's backstory of the early days of the H1N1 pandemic. I'm wondering sort of what thoughts you come away with.
It's interesting. Yeah, it was really interesting listening to Secretary Sebelius. I mean, look, we started this hour talking about President Trump's claim of total authority that he probably doesn't have. But listening to Secretary Sebelius, you know, I'm reminded that all presidents, Trump included, have a lot of power, some of it directly related to what he could do in this case. I mean, for example, just sort of random stuff. He can order federal employees to return to work. He can open national parks. But the most important thing that I heard from Secretary Sebelius is that he can use his considerable powers of persuasion to influence governors and to sort of rally the country around issues that have to do with science and what has to happen next and next steps. The problem with what happened this week is there was sort of a disconnect between the way he started this whole thing. That is, you know, by not leading at the very beginning, he left it to the governors to lead. And so the governors made their own decisions about when and how extreme their stay-at-home orders should be and so on and so forth, closing schools, closing essential businesses. So for him to then sort of emerge at the beginning of this week and say, I have ultimate authority, a lot of the governors are left sort of saying, well, wait a minute. We're the ones that made these decisions about when to close down our states. We're the ones that need to make the decisions when to open it, open them. So it's this issue of consistent messaging that I think Secretary Sebelius outlined really powerfully about what happened in another era and what hasn't been happening today.
Well, Anthony Brooks, On Point's 2020 correspondent and WBUR senior political reporter. Anthony, so great to always talk with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Meghna. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.